This is a Willets Point Shea Stadium bound 7 express train. The next and last stop is Willets Point Shea Stadium.
Yes, it is the Subway to Shea podcast. Anthony Rivera here with you, talking about all the news and happenings surrounding that team from Queens, the New York Mets. Episode 126 from the Subway to Shea studios in my office. Feeling better this week, just getting over a bout of COVID, ready to go for today's show. But first, shout out to Allison Trone, who joined me on my last episode. You can follow Al on X at My Infamous Take and catch him hosting on WFAN on the overnight. So make sure to check him out. Today's show is going to be focused on pitching, kind of an early 2024 New York Mets pitching staff outlook, kind of a preview. Obviously, the Mets can add pitching following this episode, but I want to focus on what we have at the moment, and I couldn't think of any better to do this with than my guest, former Mets pitcher Nelson Figueroa, currently is the co-host of the Amazing But True podcast with my good friend Jake Brown, and he also co-hosts Sports Nation Nightly on WPIX 11 with the Moose, Mark Melusis. Figgy, welcome to the Subway to Shea podcast. How you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well, brother. Good to see you.
Great to have you on the show. Let's get right into it. The Mets signed Sean Manaea. Last episode, it was a discussion on who we thought was the lefty that the Mets should bring in. Should have been Sean Manaea, should have been Hyunjin Ryu. And me and my guest, Allison Trone, came to the conclusion that Manaea would be the best possible solution. And, you know, a few days later, he gets signed, according to John Heyman of the New York Post, 2 years, $28 million deal with an opt-out after 2024. And the reasons why we thought that he was the best possible option, he provides another lefty in the rotation, which I think has been missing from the Mets for a while now. They usually have maybe one in the rotation. Now they got two, and it's nice to see a little change in that. Go along with Jose Quintana. He's very versatile, which means he could pitch out of the rotation. And if need be, he could pitch out of relief. We saw him do it in San Francisco last season. So it's great to see that he can do that as well. Let me bring up Manaea's stats here. And through the first half, these are his splits from the first and second half of the season. First 11 appearances, 32 and two-thirds innings pitched, a 6.81 ERA. His strikeout rate was 28.9, 17.5% walk rate, 32.6% ground ball rate, and he gave up 8 home runs. And in the final 26 appearances, it changed. The final 85 innings pitched that he had, a 3.60 ERA. That's a, you know, 3-run difference there for him. 24.4% strikeout rate went down a little bit. The walk rate went down as well, 6.8%, and a 44% ground ball rate, which we're going to see this season going to become very important because the Mets are stressing the run prevention and defense. So that's going to become very important. And he gave up 6 home runs, 2 less. And this is all via Joe Trezza of MLB.com. Figgy, what did you think of the Mets signing Sean Manaea? You think this was a good deal?
Well, I mean, he's been one of those names that you've heard about for a while now, right? One of the hot prospects, guy who made it to the big leagues, but it hasn't really translated. What I think I learned about him doing a bunch of the research as well is that he went to Driveline before last season had started to try and fix himself, make himself a little bit better. Because you never really are a finished product. You always have to make adjustments. And the league, of course, wasn't fearful of a guy who was throwing 92, 93 miles an hour. So he goes to Driveline and in hopes of trying to find some extra velo. And he did that in the first half of the season. He had added the extra velo, but it didn't translate to the numbers that he was hoping for because he was giving up home runs. Now, when you have that extra velo, you make mistakes up in the zone without pitching out of the zone. Those balls are traveling a long way and he's giving up the home run ball. Once he figured out, I guess, the way to use this newfound power, right? This newfound extra 5 miles an hour. We saw him get it up to 97, 98 miles an hour even. It was a different a different guy. You know, like the scouting reports had him down at 92, 93 miles an hour. What kind of fastball does he have? Well, it doesn't have much life on it. It doesn't stay up in the strike zone. Spin rate was a little bit different. Just the way that he was pitching was a little bit different, especially as a reliever. When you go into relief mode, you have an uptick in velocity normally. And what I liked about him more so was that he was really challenging hitters and using all of his pitches, I guess you would say, in concert to not walk people, but to challenge them. And he was getting more ground balls, less walks, and really going after people rather than trying to pitch for strikeouts. That is something that we fall into, we fall victim to so much as major league pitchers, as just pitchers in general. We get enamored with the strikeout. And so here we are, get ahead 0-2, and here it is. I'm going to throw five pitches to strike this guy out. Meanwhile, you throw four balls in the midst and you wind up walking him. So I think you start learning that you're looking for just a guy to not barrel up the ball. If he doesn't barrel up the baseball, professional guys behind you, 9 times out of 10, even more so, probably 9.5 times out of 10, it's going to be an out. So you have to have the confidence in doing that. And I think that's something that has changed. And when you're young, you do have a bunch of strikeouts, or you struck out a lot of guys in the minor leagues, you're still looking for that to be that guy. He isn't that kind of guy. He isn't a guy that's going to, you know, strike out the world. He can set people up. He can make the ball move around the strike zone. And the second half was, I think, what we saw was the new Sean Manaea, the way that he's capable of pitching. And so that's why he was deserving of that deal. It's a 1-year deal technically, because he has the opt out. So if he pitches lights out, you know, he's going to go somewhere and try and cash in on a deal, especially with left-handers. Not too many left-handed starting pitchers in the free agent market. You know, with these two big ones that are going to be signing this year, next year, of course, we'll see who's going to be available. But I do think I like the signing. I really do. I think you're essential with 1-year deals going all the way around. If you look at Bader and Severino and all this, there's no such thing as a bad 1-year deal, right? It's only money. And if the guy exceeds expectation, then it's a great 1-year deal. Now it's, you know, do you want to think he can duplicate it and then sign him long-term? So I like the deal. I think he's going to play well. I think, you know, a guy like Joey Lucchese, who we've seen in spurts and has had some really good success, is a guy who, he's still only 27 years old. I think he's still on the young side. He's, you know, still on the short side of 30. He's another guy, a lefty, that could be used. But now you have him as organizational depth, where you were counting on him before to be one of these, you know, fifth or sixth starters. Now he's a little bit further down the line. But I like the move. I think it makes him stronger. I really still, we haven't gotten a chance to talk, I really like the Severino deal, because Severino's stuff, as far as his fastball, he hadn't gotten any worse with his fastball. He was still one of the hardest throwers in baseball. He has to use his fastball differently. And one of the biggest things that he even said in the press conference the other day was he knows he tips pitches. Everyone knew he tips pitches. And so that's why everybody was always on his slider and on his changeup. It wasn't that there were bad pitches. It was just, he literally was telling them, I'm throwing a changeup here. And if it got too much of the plate, it got hammered. And I think if they're able to get him to fix that tipping issue, he still has the stuff to be a really good middle of the rotation starter.
And both of these guys have been, assets at Driveline and have been working at Driveline and trying to fix whatever issues they've been going through. We're going to get into Severino and the whole tipping issue shortly with Manaea. And I don't know if he learned this at Driveline, but that sweeper that he had, hitters were slashing 140, 161, 163, 35.1% whiff rate. He used it most in August, which was 25% of the time. And that's when his ERA was at its best. It was at 3.15. For those who may not know what a sweeper is, can you delve a little bit into that?
Well, what it is baseball went into this phase of upper 90s fastball with a 91 to 93 mile an hour slider, which used to be a cutter back in my day. So it was a smaller movement, sharper movement, later movement, right? And so that became the new slider that was being thrown by everybody. And so now all hitters in baseball are used to seeing that. Now they're calling what used to be our slider, which was harder than our curveball, but it still had a little bit more break than a cutter, is a sweeper now. It's an old school slider, so it's in that lower 83, 84 mile an hour range, and it has a lot more horizontal movement. So what it does is it sweeps across the strike zone. Some guys are able to change the axis and actually keep it flatter, or even make it look like it almost rises depending on the arm angle, where that sweeping action, it's kind of tough for a hitter to look for, because they're used to seeing the ball dive down and dive away. So say for a right-handed hitter, it would dive away. For a left-handed hitter, dive away from their bats, and they're looking to stay on top of that, stay on plane. Now this thing stays flat across the zone and it's a bigger sweeping motion. That's what a sweeper is. It used to be called our sliders. Now they call it sweepers. I don't know why they went there with that.
And how could Manaea best utilize this right now? Because he's going to be put in the rotation. Obviously, he learned it mostly for the bullpen. This was used throughout August. Once he became to September and he started getting back into the rotation, he kind of, used it a little bit less. Is there a strategy behind that for the rotation and for the bullpen? Or is that just because you don't want to exert, more, energy in that arm?
Well, I think it all depends, right? If you're a one inning kind of relief guy, then you're going to show what you got because you're only going to face those three hitters. That's the hope, right? So you're going to go with the best 1-2 punch, whatever it is that night. And that's one of the things when you go from being a starter to a reliever and bouncing back and forth. As a starter, they always had you working on 3 to 4 pitches. As a reliever, they want you to master. The fastball has to be mastered already. So you have to have that secondary pitch mastered. Your out pitch, your go-to pitch, your pitch that's going to elicit soft contact or swing and miss stuff, which became his cutter his sweeper. So that to me is where, yes, he can use it when it's only three hitters much more, I would say, prolifically, as compared to when you're a starter, you kind of want to wait for the right moments to use it. You can get by with just using your fastball, so 4-seam, 2-seam, up in the zone, down in the zone, inside, outside. That's enough to get you through the first time through the lineup. You don't have to get too tricky, too fancy with it. So that's why the numbers are down on it. When you get to 2 strikes and you want to put a guy away, of course, sure, go to the sweeper, see if you can get a swing and miss, a pop up, an easy weak ground ball, and that's what you're looking to do. But I think there's a ratio that he will get comfortable with. And all pitchers come into this where they realize, hey, these are my best 2 pitches. This is what I'm going to go with. And depending on who's facing him, when do I have to use it? If I have to use it, do I save it until somebody gets on second base? Because with a guy on first base, if I can use my sinker and get a ground ball double play, why go and make a mistake with a ball, up in the zone? So I think that's part of about learning how to pitch and learning what kind of pitcher you are. So going from the success that he had as a reliever, and a guy like Seth Lugo is a perfect example, right? We saw what he was able to do. He had several pitches that he could throw, but his best 1-2 were that fastball curveball combination. But if he was starting, he needed to do more. He couldn't just go out there with the 1-2 and just keep showing the same routine. You got to be a little bit unpredictable. So I think that's where, as a starter, he can still use his other pitches, be a little bit unpredictable, and not fall into a rut of 82% of the time with 2 strikes, he's going to throw that sweeper, because then it tips off the hitters that they have an idea of what's coming and what he likes to go to.
I find it so interesting that the Mets, a few days beforehand, they signed Harrison Bader, who's a great center fielder. You got the good defense up the middle, which will probably be McNeil and Lindor. And to have that behind a guy in Sean Manaea, and whether it's, left field for Brandon Nimmo or he's in center field, the defense the team has, the Mets bringing in Joey Wendell as well, even, and Pete's a pretty, I think, good first baseman and playing defensively, and I like what I see from him. Every year I see him improving. This could only help Sean Manaea.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And I think that's one of the biggest things, is that we've heard for years how you have to be strong up the middle defensively, right? That's your catcher, that's your shortstop, second baseman, and your center fielder. Brandon Nimmo has played unbelievable center field over the past couple of years, gotten better and better. It got him the big multi-year deal, and they changed some of the things about him. He used to play shallow. They wound up moving him back a little bit further so that you're moving only in one direction. The way that the outfield position is being played now is crazy. Like, they literally have laser sights that they say, hey, about 320 feet away, this is the mark you want to be at for every hitter. Start at 320 feet away, and then work your way in. Because on average, that's where the ball is hit. And it works for the most part. This is part of the game where these advanced metrics are really helping defensively, helping guys like a Brandon Nimmo, who was always a good athlete, but he just was never really made you feel confident in center field. We saw a different guy there last year. He was tremendous. And now you're bringing a guy like Harrison Bader, Gold Glove winner. We saw, he can go get him with the best of them. And I think that's one of the things, has always been a health issue with him. It's always been, it's a Juan Lagares thing, right? The guy is a tremendous center fielder until he hurts himself. And he's always bound to hurt himself because he's a tremendous center fielder. He goes all out. He runs hard. He plays hard. And as you get older, you kind of start to realize, there's a give and a take to certain things. Aaron Judge running through a wall last year. I hope that's the last time he ever tries to run through through a wall because a pitcher made a bad pitch. There's rhyme and reason. I'm more a value if I can play than me making this unbelievable catch. And whether he went through the wall because he didn't know he's going to go through the wall, but he was still going to bang into that wall pretty hard. The risk versus reward is not there when you're playing 162 games. We saw when he was out of the lineup. So for Bader, I think it's a great chance to bounce back, a great chance he's comfortable in New York. He's a New York kid. Brandon Nimmo playing some left field. It's only going to help defensively on that side. Starling Marte, once he's over the double groin surgery and vertigo or whatever else he was dealing with the neck injury, he just never looked like himself last year. I see him already playing winter ball. I see the swing is still there just as quick. I'm hoping for an unbelievable bounce back year for Starling Marte because I think he is truly a very talented outfielder. If you can have that guy in right field playing like a center fielder as well, I feel like, you know, they have the outfield pretty well covered. So defense is huge for any pitcher. But for a guy like Manaea, the more ground balls you get, the more outs that should be gotten, keep the ball from being in the air. The fewer the home runs you give up, of course, you're trying to, even though the shift isn't there where you're playing one step off the base, you know, they are really good athletes that are able to get to the other side, especially like a guy like Lindor, who is a vacuum there and is still one of the best in all of baseball.
Let's look at this rotation that the Mets have going on here. And this is currently what the outlook is going to be. Kodai Senga is probably going to be the ace at this point, with Jose Quintana, Luis Severino slotting in at number three, Sean Manaea and Adrian Hauser, who they got in the trade with Milwaukee. Severino, if it all works for Severino, could possibly be that kind of comeback player type of the year. This is a guy that could slot in, you know, and even the Yankees at a certain point thought that he would be their ace, or at least a 1A, 1B to a Cole Hamels. If the Mets are done at this moment in time, and that's, we're hearing conflicting reports that the Mets were done finding starting pitching, then they're looking at trades and they're just going to see how things work out if price falls. Right. If they are done, can this current rotation as we see right now as is, do you think it can compete? Because that's been the big talk, is the Mets being competitive this season. Can this rotation compete as David Stearns discussed?
Well, I think one of the biggest things about any rotation in all of baseball is health, right? That's number one, first and foremost. Can they be healthy enough for those five guys to really make an impact? Even last year when they had, you know, two future Hall of Famers signed in, they had Quintana brought into the rotation, Senga was a rookie coming over, you know, you had your number five starter was Carlos Carrasco, who was, you know, over the last 10 years, one of the better pitchers in the American League. You figure, wow, that's a tremendous number five. But health is always the issue, right? Those five guys never pitched together, not one time through the rotation. So there's no way of saying. I do think they're going to be competitive. I think that the way that they're going to be used and the kind of pitchers that they are, they can, you know, give you at least 5 to 6 innings. We see the major league average now is 5 2/3, with 9 teams this year or last year weren't even averaging 5 innings for their starters. 9 teams didn't average 5 innings for their starters. And so what are you looking for? What are you built to do? Do you have the bullpen to sustain guys only going 4 2/3? Do you have, you know, guys that are capable of giving you a little bit more and then that back end of the bullpen? How are you built on the back end of the bullpen? We know Diaz coming back is someone you have a high confidence level in. Raley is still around, a very good lefty who we liked what we saw from him last year. I still think they, you know, go back and get Robertson again. I think Robertson was a tremendous asset last year, and he was very comfortable here. So I think Robertson would be great. So I think there's a way to look at it where, yes, they can compete, because I'll ask you this question. If you can name me the 5 starters for either World Series team, I'll give you $1,000.
For the this past World Series team? I don't think I can name all 5.
Right. Oh, even I'll make it even worse, because it was going to be opening day for both teams.
Yeah,
you couldn't,
no.
Right? So that's my point, is that there's no way that you could tell me that the Diamondbacks went into last season saying, man, we're going to the World Series. Look how we're built. And yet they wound up there, right? Because they got hot at the right time. They did the right things. They had the right pieces in place. They went and got literally guys, you know, you got a guy like Paul Sewald who got an opportunity and pitched tremendous for them down the stretch. stretch. I think when you look at how baseball is played, and yes, the marathon thing is a correct adage of, you know, you kind of have to tread water long enough to then be able to make an impact. What I love about the Mets and the situation that they're in is that they have now a president of baseball operations who is valuing defense more so than anything else. The Milwaukee Brewers over the last 5 years have the number one defense, the defensive runs saved in all of baseball, where the Mets are somewhere in the 25th, 26th spot, right? Yeah. And so you look at, and you go back and you look at all these Milwaukee teams, because nobody paid attention to Milwaukee. But meanwhile, you go back and you look and see how many times they were 1-2 in their division, and not an easy division. They're either 1-2 in their division. And what was it about them? It was pitching and defense. It was two of the biggest things. They had good pieces in place, but they had a lot of interchangeable parts. And they went out and got a major piece in a Christian Yelich. So that shows that he knows how to make the big move. He can make the big move because he's going to have the financial backing from an ownership group who didn't shy away from ponying up $325 million for Yamamoto. So I do think, like, going to start it out, yeah, there's always question marks. And there's a rookie manager, you know, what exactly is that going to mean? Because there's probably going to be a blueprint in place for every single game. And he's going to have to be able to, you know, execute said blueprint, and more so than anything, handle the media and handle the clubhouse as a first-year manager. That's going to be the biggest test for a guy like Carlos Mendoza. But I do think they're trying to put together a competitive team. And listen, the Braves are the Braves. They're in there every year for the playoffs. Yep. Philadelphia has not gotten any weaker. Miami was up and coming, and who knows, because they're trying to trade away pieces. We keep hearing Lizardo's name thrown around. So the National League East, as we say every year, the National League Beast is not going to be easy. So to sit back and just think, even when the Mets spent $350 million, that it was theirs for the taking. No, it's still the Braves that are the cream of the crop. It's still the Braves that are, you know, while they have all those guys locked up to these pennies on the dollar deals, that I still can't understand how they get this lucky. You know, we're sitting here trying to figure out how, you know, what Pete Alonso is going to get, where you look at on the other side, they just paid Olson $21 million and he went off for 53 and 135. So I think one of the things is that you have to have this almost blind faith. I feel much more confident in what Stearns has been able to do than what Billy Epler was able to do. Because I said about Billy Epler from the beginning, we saw him in Anaheim with a almost unlimited budget with two of the best players on the planet. And I asked people, you know, relentlessly, name me some of their starter pitchers that you've ever heard of. Name me some of their bullpen pieces that you've ever heard. You've never heard of anybody other than those two major players. And they went out and they call us the Rodon signing from the Nationals was a disaster. So those things were happening, but it was like we saw almost the same kind of thing happening with Billy Epler. Once they won the 101 games and Buck Showalter was at the helm, they said, you know what? Now let's really go for it. This is the time to go all in. And they went all in. Hindsight is 2020. There was a lot of things that went wrong, health being number one on it. But I do feel in my heart of hearts that that team would have found their stride and been able to win 85 games instead of 84 games, being the wild card team, being the Diamondbacks who went all the way to the World Series.
There's a podcast that I follow called Mets Weekly, and their host Carson had posted a graphic of David Stearns' time in Milwaukee and the pitchers there. Every year, it was a six-man rotation. And yes. I wonder if that's going to happen, if we're going to get another starting pitcher, if one of the, you know, Tyler McGills, Luke Casey's, or David Peterson, when eventually he comes back, Jose Budo, he's another option, if they're going to go that route. And I like that you mentioned the fact about the average of innings here. And, you know, the Mets really need 5 innings a night. It's not going to always happen, but it barely happened last season.
Yeah.
The Mets need 5 innings a night for this team to really succeed. And something, like I said, that we barely saw last season, why has it just, I guess, in general in baseball, why has it become so hard for starting pitchers to go 5 to 6 innings? Because I don't know if it's just and you can, you know, elaborate on this, if it's just a analytics thing. And then, you know, when they teach these guys this in the minor leagues, then the stamina is not there. And then they may go 4 or less.
Right. It's twofold, right? I think one of the things that we talk about, these athletes are bigger, stronger, faster, right? And there's only for so long that you can go pedal to the metal trying to throw 100 miles an hour before something breaks down. And no matter who you are, including the unbelievably great Jacob deGrom, who's the best pitcher on the planet when healthy, we saw that with him, right? It's we have perfected things to an essence where if I took a machine and just had it, you know, say put a hammer in its hand and just had it just hammer in one spot, it's going to wear out that spot pretty quickly, right? It's the same thing with pitching. The mechanics have gotten so perfect and everything has to be so executed so perfectly that the old school mechanics were a little bit funky, a little bit drop and drive, a little bit of twist and turn, right? It wasn't so linear up and down. And for my money, I think we are wearing these pitchers out because they're doing the same thing over and over and over and over again. They're not able to downshift. They're not able to, you know, slowly build up and then in the fourth, fifth, sixth inning, let the ball go with max effort because you're getting towards the end of that 80 to 90 to 100 pitch count. Right now, we're seeing these guys coming out to shoot, giving it all they got because they know they're only going to be in for four innings. So they want to maximize that time that they're in there. They're going out there looking to get their 12 strikeouts in the first three innings. Meanwhile, guys that I think I came up with, you kind of got a feel for what the other team was doing first. It was kind of like a sparring match, right? Are they taking pitches early? Because I know as a rookie or, you know, a guy who wasn't game planned for, the biggest thing that they would do with me is they would take the first time through the lineup. They would try to let me nibble on the corners and work myself into walks and into situations of, you know, having to throw fastballs and fastball counts. And so when you get older and you understand that, you kind of go and attack early on in the count and you know, use your sinker, make the ball move a little bit early on, get some ground balls. You know, one pitch ground ball out is way better than a seven pitch strikeout. But these kids don't get that anymore. They're trying to go for these strikeouts and pumping the numbers and their gas pedal, you know, pedal to the metal. They don't have a feel for pitching. There's no changing speeds the way there used to be. And when you see guys that change speeds, you're like, wow, that looks so different nowadays. So I think that's one of the biggest things. That's A. B, when you're told, when you were coming up and when you were growing up, you were trying to go nine innings to show off for the scouts. You were going nine innings in the minor leagues to get, you know, promoted because you were a guy who was a gamer who could go that deep into a game and you were that good that you could dominate the other team for that long. That's changed now because they're really, the focus is so, everyone has a specialty, right? The sixth inning guy, the seventh inning guy, the eighth inning guy, the closer, everybody has a specialty. The lefty for the lefties, even though it's not just a one batter thing anymore, unless it's two outs in that inning. But you're always going to see that this game is, well, you are supposed to go two times through the lineup. That makes you a star. Because now we have openers. A six-man rotation, the Mets were going to try and do that last year because remember, Kodai Senga wasn't used to throwing your fifth day. So the plan was six starter, but two guys were hurt before they even left spring training. So they didn't have an opportunity to do that. So I think they were thinking of doing that, but they didn't have the personnel. The depth has to be there. I said this on our show the other day that the Mets can't be just five starters. It has to be eight, nine starters deep that will give you major league quality appearances. And if that's only going to be 4 2/3 of one or two runs of baseball, then that's what it's got to be. But it cannot be, hey, we're down seven runs in the second inning every fifth day because you don't have guys that can fill that role.
You know, I don't feel like this, the way that they're doing the analytics and with the pitching, you know, the injuries are so important to that. And, you know, it really hasn't helped injuries at all. I don't think at all. I feel like there's more injuries now than there was with pitching. And the fact that they have to go to the bullpen so early every day. And you know, they are running through depth through the minor leagues, and they did it last year. The Mets have now gotten all these depth pieces that they signed this offseason as well. And there's only, you know, a 26-man roster. Like, I feel like maybe they need to expand that a little bit, make it have more pitching, because the guys on the field, there are injuries, but I feel like it's a lot less than what you see with pitching. I feel like there's a lot more pitching injuries. And then there's also, you know, when you sign these guys in free agency, these pitchers are making a ton more money than the guys that play on the field. And you're paying these starting pitchers money that probably should have been paid to a guy like, and I know the times are different. I know money's different, but like, you know, Dwight Gooden would have been paid a load of money. Seaver, all those guys, even guys like Al Leiter who went the distance in a lot of his games. That's the money that I'm seeing given out now to guys that are only going 5 to 6 innings and you know, sometimes four and less.
Listen, it gets even worse than that when you consider that Trevor Bauer was the one who initially started this whole trend of $40 plus million for a starting pitcher, a guy who may pitch 30, perform in 30 games for you. And when you look at where the value is for that, I think that if you can, because if you're saying to me that it would be okay for him to go out there and only go 5 2/3 making that kind of money, then what's that say for a kid, making the major league minimum, which is $700,000, which is still fantastic compared to back in my day when we were making $180,000. I get that. It's all relative. So I will never question the money. I do, though, say to myself, this guy pitched 11 really good games, which anybody can have a nice 11 game streak in a season. When it comes to 30, 33, 34 starts in a season, that's where a Cy Young is made. And he had one good season like this. And then he goes over to the Dodgers and the Mets were willing to pay him that money as well. Remember that. So that don't let that go by the wayside. The Mets made him the same kind of offer and he got that offer. And then it kind of just, because then how do you compare Trevor Bauer to a guy like Verlander, right? It's not even apples to oranges. Those are both fruit. It's apples to rocks. I mean, the guy had a good year. Verlander's had an amazing career. So now the value for these guys are $45 million a year, but you're telling me that a guy like Pete Alonso, or even, let's go with Matt Olson, is making $21 million a year, yet he can change the game every single at bat, every single game, because he played 162 games the last two seasons. I think that's something that has to get looked at as well, because I get it. You're paying for a premium for premium athletes. But at the same time, I haven't seen the expectations be met, to be with that, the value of that money. So I don't know. I think baseball lost their mind with that a little bit. And unfortunately, that may come back to the pack, because you're seeing, two lefties that normally you would have felt like were locked up by now. Guys coming off his second Cy Young, and all of baseball's kind of pumping the brakes on just throwing money out there. So I think that's, this is one of the things we're looking at. And even when you look at a guy like, Pete about to go, he's got the arbitration coming through. And then next year, of course, where does he rank? Because just a few years ago, and I talked about this on our shows, that remember Chris Carter led the American League with 41 home runs. The following year, nobody would sign him because they said, oh, the metrics about everything else that he does, and he's just a home run hitter, they're not there. But he hit 41 home runs and drove in over 100. And he wound up having to swallow a deal, a $2 million deal with the Yankees, and then winds up getting released. You know what I'm saying? So like, where's the onus? Where's the value? What are you looking to do? And so for, everyone in baseball, like the markets are crazy where you see Ohtani get $700 million and defer $680 million of it. I mean, no one would ever have thought that that was even a possibility, let alone not just a reality, but it created the space that they could go and get a second Japanese player who could be a generational type talent, and pay him handsomely. And then you see Tosca Hernandez going out there and taking a one-year deal, getting paid handsomely for a one-year deal, and deferring $8 million of that as well. So it's just a different time when it comes to where the money is, where the value is, and where the return on investment is, I guess, in baseball.
I hate to say this because I can't stand the Yankees, but, Gerrit Cole is probably the best return in investment of a starting pitcher that we've seen this past decade. The way that he's pitched, he goes 6 to 7 innings. He can pitch in the playoffs for those 6 to 7 innings as well. And, to see what he has done, kudos to him. And speaking of his teammate, which we talked a little bit about earlier, Luis Severino, this was a guy that at the beginning of the offseason and when we were trying to build this rotation was definitely a guy I thought, I think we should sign him, be a fourth, fifth starter. I think he would be perfect for that. Like I said, possible, comeback player of the year type. And he's pitched in New York with the Yankees. He's pitched in the postseason. His comments during the introductory press conference the other day, he said that the thing that keeps him going is the pressure. He loves being under pressure. He loves New York for a long time. He was happy to be with the organization with the Mets, and he wants to continue to feel the pressure. You don't hear that too much from pitchers these days, and especially a gamer like Sevy, who really had one of his, he had his worst season and one of the worst worst seasons for a pitcher in baseball. But like I said, I really do see Seve, if all breaks, you know, right, which, you know, never always happens. But if all right. could break right, like I said, Seve could be a comeback player of the year.
Yeah, no, without a doubt, I think you hit the nail on the head when it comes to the risk versus reward that we talked about, right? You're talking about paying him $13 million. I get it. He made more money, and he had coming off a bad year where he's only making $10 million. But if you look at what the bad year was, it was a minus 1.5 WAR. That's it. So you're telling me he's only 1.5 games worse than the average replacement. That was in his worst year, okay? Go back before that. And yes, injuries have taken their toll. We saw that with Matt Harvey, but Matt Harvey lost his fastball, right? Severino has not lost his fastball. So I think that's where you say, hey, there is hope. We just have to get him to pitch a little bit differently. We got to get him to understand what his true strengths are. And one of his biggest strengths had always been that changeup, throwing that changeup in fastball counts, then elevating out of the zone with that fastball. Too many times he found barrels at the top of the strike zone. And we're not talking about pitching to the top of the strike zone. We're talking about pitching out of the strike zone at the top of it. And that's the biggest difference between him and Jacob deGrom, right? Jacob deGrom just did not miss at the top of the zone. He threw that ball and it just seemed to rise out of the strike zone. Severino had that kind of life on his fastball as well. And I saw Adam Ottavino do an SNY hit talking about how he probably lost an inch of movement on his fastball. And so you're talking about going from plus in that top part of the zone to average. And what average means is that it's staying truer. It's not continuing to ride through the zone longer. And that's where you get the swings and misses, because guys are thinking, okay, that ball's coming down just a little bit and I'm going to meet it. Oh, it stayed up above the zone and I get a foul ball. Now they were getting doubles instead. So I think there's ways that you can look at it, you know, analytically, and just watching him pitch and knowing the person that he was, right? You have to realize he went out there every fifth day and tried to be that number one guy. And they asked him that question the other day, you know, where do you see yourself now? Are you a two, a three, a four? And he said, I don't care. And I used to say the same thing. What do you think? I'm going to go out there and say I'm going to pitch like a number five starter? No, I'm a number one. You know why I'm a number one? Because I'm the only person on this damn mound. So I'm a number one pitcher today. I'm the best option that this team has today of all days. And so Severino has the pedigree to go out there and still have that kind of swagger, still have that kind of confidence. And I want to see when that confidence meets the stuff and that plays together, because there's no way that you can tell me like, oh, wow, you know, he just doesn't have it. We saw when Matt Harvey didn't have it. We see now Noah Syndergaard doesn't have it. You know, there's a big difference between the way that Severino's throwing a baseball and the way that those guys were throwing the baseball in their latter years.
You know, even during the struggles for Seve, the velocity was still there for him, which is a really good sign. And you mentioned the talk about the tipping pitches. Is that something that could be an easy fix for Jeremy Hefner and you know, that whole crew with the pitching staff?
It is, and it's easier done in the offseason than it is during the season, because you immediately go back to what's comfortable. As soon as you get hit, you go back to what's comfortable. And it's not that he's tipping in the windup. He's tipping in the stretch. Those are the most critical times that you can't be tipping, because you're now giving them something to look for every single time. And he knew he was doing it. We've all known that he was doing it. And whatever it is, and it has to do with glove positioning, it was just something that he was so comfortable doing, he couldn't stop doing it. And even if he stopped doing it for a batter or two, he would go back to it. All right. Case in point, like, have you seen the John Boy did an unbelievable breakdown about they faced the Detroit Tigers rookie pitcher last year, the Yankees did. And the first time through the lineup, the kid was throwing fantastic. Second time through the lineup, all of a sudden they got a guy on base and that was it. They hit like, I want to say four doubles, three home runs. The guy was just getting tattooed. And it was something as simple as when he was taking his signs for his pitches, if he stayed looking straight, it was a fastball. If he took his sign and then he looked towards third base when he came up set, it was a breaking ball. And this kid had already pitched in the minor leagues, but this is one of the things that he skyrocketed through the minor leagues so quickly that nobody really picked up on it. And he was doing so well that nobody really cared. And so then when he got to the big leagues and his first start against the Yankees, they picked it apart and it made it that easy. So just imagine Severino had this kind of a season when all of the American League, especially, knew what was coming. And if he can get away with that and still have only a minus 0.15 WAR, then I think you're going to see much better results this year, as long as he can get rid of that one tipping issue, because I think his fastball plays, I think the way that he's going to use his changeup a little bit more will help out. And the slider, it looks to me like the driveline videos that I've seen, his slider's turning into a little bit more of a cutter. So he has an understanding of this thing is not going to be 12-6 dropping out of the strike zone. It's going to be a shorter, quicker movement, and hopefully get, you know, more contact off the end of the bat than the barrel.
I recently reposted that video from Driveline showing Seve with his off speed pitches. Driveline has been implemented big time with Jeremy Hefner and this Mets organization. What are your thoughts on Driveline in general?
For professional athletes, because they are already fully developed, and it's more about kind of tinkering. It's basically when you go to a shop and you're modding a supercar already, you know, like you're putting some extra things into it. There's some aftermarket things that can be done. But it's like for the younger kids, I feel like they're not developed enough to understand it, to do it, and to reap the benefits of it. A lot of the stuff used to be, you know, a lot of the throwing the heavier weighted baseballs around, and they would do it just to do it because everybody was doing it. But each person is different, so you can't go so cookie cutter. And Driveline's gotten a lot better with that. They had a program, and everybody would try to follow that program, but then they realized that some guys are built differently, and you can't just do that. So now they do a 3D mapping of these guys, or even 4D, where, you know, they put all the points all over their bodies, and they watch them throw, and they watch the way they move, and they realize that they have inefficiencies even as professional athletes, and the way that they move their body. Manaea was one of the guys who his torso didn't rotate enough, and that's where he was losing 3 to 4 miles an hour of his fastball. And then they found his arm slot. Hey, what kind of pitcher are you going to be? Your arm slot has to match with what you're trying to do. So all those little things for professional athletes, it's great. And it's so funny to see these guys going there. And you're like, wait a minute, this is something that, you know, the kids are doing just to try and to be seen and to get better. And you're never a finished product. And so when you have a pitching coach who understands that, Matt Blake was another guy who came through a familiar system like that. But it was the actual in-game stuff where for a guy like Severino tipping, you know, Blake wasn't able to get through to him enough to or have the trust of Severino, where Severino, you know, one of the things he said in the press conference was, you know, about Hefner is that he's played the game before. I noticed that when he said that. He said he's played the game before, so he kind of understands. And that's one of the things. You understand what needs to be done because you've had the successes, you've had the failures as a pitching coach like Hefner has. He's had two Tommy John surgeries, and he wasn't able to come back after the second one, which is, I tell people about Ohtani all the time. I was like, Jeremy Hefner had two Tommy Johns, and he's a pitching coach. Not saying that Ohtani will be, but there's no certainty that he'll come back, you know, better than before, especially after a second one. But I think that's one of the things, is that he has these guys, and he's put together some really good programs. But when I look at last year's team, unfortunately, maybe it was because you had two Hall of Famers leading it, and you expected to lead by example, that the regression of Peterson and of McGill was disappointing, highly disappointing. You know, like you got what you got out of Senga. You didn't know what you were going to get. You just allowed him to do his thing, and he got better and better, and he used his cutter. But Quintana, you know, you had to wait to see what he could do, and he had, you know, put his career back on track and did exactly what you thought he was going to do. But I really was shocked at the regression of Peterson and McGill, because I felt like McGill had shown flashes of that frontline type starter, and he was going to be around these two guys who are Hall of Famers. I mean, I know when I got to the Mets and I had Santana to my left and Pedro Martinez to my right, I was nothing but questions. I was nothing but, show me how you grip this. You know, why would you do that? What situations do you think this would work in? What do I need to do better? I was nonstop doing that. I was in their ear constantly trying to do that. But I don't know if those two guys were as readily available to talk with or learn from, you know, because they're focused on what they're doing. So it was disappointing to me the way that staff mapped out. And of course, the fact that they never fixed the bullpen problem when Diaz went down. They never went out to get help.
Do you put anything into their strong finish? Because I thought McGill and Peterson, although a little less Peterson, but more of McGill, even a Jose Budo. Do you put anything into their strong finish, or was it just, you know, September, all the call-ups and stuff like that?
That's the part, right? They always say, don't look at spring training and don't look of September. But at the same time, hey, it's a confidence builder. You know, they went out there and they performed in the major leagues against major league hitters, and they got guys out and they saw what they can do. And they ended on a more positive note than, you know, the way that they struggled all year long. So it happens to everybody. There's a crossroad, right? Of hey, you got to either be able to do it or it's never going to happen. Yeah, you know, some guys it happens later. Some guys are thrusted. I mean, McGill's a guy who was just thrusted into the rotation because of injuries throughout the beginning part of his career. You never felt like it was his turn to be that guy. And then now that, you know, he's looking around now, and what are you seeing? Shit, I might be in Syracuse again. I don't want to be in Syracuse. Well, what are you going to have to do? You're going to have to perform and outpitch all these guys, because these guys got major league contracts, right? If you have options still, well, it makes it easy to know that you're probably going down unless there's an injury. But you have to go into that spring training like it's everything. Like you're showing them everything you got from day one. You don't have time to kind of, yeah, you know, I'm going to just throw a 20-pitch bullpen here today, just fastballs and no changeups, no nothing. Hey, you know what I was working on all offseason? I was working on getting a little bit more movement out of my changeup. My two-seamer does this. I know what I'm doing out there. And I think that is one of the things that you're hoping that these guys learned from last year, because you have to learn something from a year of great expectations like that. And it should only make you better. Peterson, of course, has had the injury and the surgery ever since. So who knows when he's going to be back. But I think a guy like McGill, you know, it's the writing's on the wall. Like, the opportunity is there for him. The guy like Drew Smith, same thing. Like, yeah. Can we keep seeing the same Drew Smith every single time? Because you know what happens. He has a streak in there of, wow, this guy's pretty good. And then all of a sudden, oh my gosh, he's throwing that curveball, the slider again that keeps leaving the ballpark. So hopefully he's able to go to the lab with Hefner and fix all these little things. And they have spring training to map out some of these things and try some of these things. And that's where you see these guys being able to take their game to the next level.
This is a big evaluation year for David Stearns and company. Once again, I'm here with former Mets pitcher Nelson Figueroa. He co-hosts Amazing But True podcast, where you can listen to wherever you listen to your podcast, as well as Sports Nation Nightly on WPIX 11. Let's get into the bullpen. Andy Martino of SNY said the Mets have roughly $10 million to spend. And it will probably be focused on the relief pitching. And a couple of guys that have been talked about, and Joel Sherman of the New York Post had mentioned these guys. One of them, I had to fix the slide because one of them got taken off today in Brent Suter. It's Wandy Peralta and John Brebbia, one lefty, one righty. And these two guys have been kind of linked to the Mets. Any of these guys intrigue you at all, or is there any relief that maybe we haven't heard about? I know you mentioned David Robertson. Any guy that the Mets should be looking into?
Well, I'm a big Robertson fan. I think, you know, he shows that he can play in New York and he can handle the pressure of having to close if need be, or, you know, at least finishing games for you and you don't have to worry about it. Ottavino was just a guy who could not pitch with, a game on the line, eighth inning, because of his slow movements to the plate and the new pickoff rules really hurt him. I was very surprised to see him opt out the way he did, because it was just glaring that he couldn't be used in that capacity anymore. Wandy Peralta would be a great asset because, again, knows how to pitch in New York, can close, can do a lot of the little things at the back end of the bullpen. And, you know, he's battle tested. So I like those two choices. I think in this day and age, like, you saw how many guys they have signed, and these guys here at Picks laugh at me because all these guys that they're signing have like six ERAs or haven't pitched in the big leagues in 2 years or haven't. And I go, there's a reason. There's always a reason. There's a reason why. And what I think I also like is that they're not trying to have the same look four times, five times over in the bullpen. They've got guys who throw from different arm angles. They got guys who have different kinds of pitches, the sweeper, the, you know, a cutter, a guy who has a forkball. There's a lot of that. So I think there's a lot more thought being put into how this bullpen is being put together and what pieces fit, and not necessarily the names, not necessarily, hey, let's throw an 8-year contract at somebody, you know, just to say that we did, because they're also looking at next year's free agent class. That's something that you have to be cognizant as well, because you go out and put yourself in a situation this year. Let me look at Carlos Rodon for the Yankees. You know, they went all in because he was the best left-handed pitcher that the market had. And I think that's what's kind of making them hesitant a little bit on Blake Snell, or, you know, Jordan Montgomery is more so. I think that Jordan Montgomery is still pissed off that they got rid of him. Yeah. I see Stroman is very close to signing. It says here 3 minutes ago from The Athletic. So a guy like Stroman in the rotation for the Yankees, I had said it, I thought it was a great fit. Guy with a 3.65 ERA throughout his career. New York kid who would love nothing more than the pitch in New York. York. You need those kinds of guys. You need the guys that, you know, can weather the storm and they have a little moxie to them. Yeah, sure. He can tend to do some things that aggravate people. But at the same time, I'd take that over cookie cutter, just worried about my performance and, you know, don't worry about my teammates. I've never heard a teammate say anything bad about him. You know, that's the funny part. Everybody keeps saying, oh, Stroman this, oh, Stroman that. I go, but not one of his teammates ever said, like, that guy's terrible teammate. So I look at, they have to do something with the relievers. They have to get a little, it's going to be depth that they've already tried to add with some of these lesser than names, or where they feel like they can rehab them or, you know, make them better. I think David Stearns has a good track record with the Housers of the world. You look at Woodruff, you look at Barnes, they're all built the same way. They seem to be the same guy. Like, you could take their pictures and they're interchangeable. And he's done a tremendous job with limited resources in Milwaukee. And he didn't come here and just say, hey, you know what? I'm just going to buy. They made offers. The only thing I didn't understand was the lack of the Ohtani offer. They didn't call us. Remember that? They didn't call their camp. Didn't call me. He said, I was like, what are you talking about? That's like saying I'm not dating the hottest girl in school because she didn't call me. That's no reason. Like, you know, he's available. You know, he's out there. I thought they would be, you know, wooing him or whatever. But hey, $700 million. That's a high price to pay. Not that he's not worth it. We'll see. I think, yes, the bullpen is going to be something that is going to not just be who do you sign. It's plan B and plan C, because when those things happen, like last year, there was no plan B or C.
And you know, people may sign at the signings. People may get frustrated. A lot of Met fans frustrated with a lot of these, you know, minor league or spring invite type guys that they've been bringing in. They're not flashy names, but guess what? We're probably going to see most of them this season when you have a guy like Edwin Diaz coming back, you know, from the injury that he did. They're not going to just rush him back and throw him into eighth and ninth innings. They're going to use Brooks Raley a lot, especially if he's the only lefty, which I hope he's not. So these guys are going to get their opportunity. And the thing about David Stearns, like you mentioned, he's been a guy that has put together bullpens quite well. So hopefully this year he could do that with the Mets. And we talked about McGill, Buddo, Peterson, and Lucchesi as depth in the rotation. But with Mike Vasile, Christian Scott, Dom Hamill, Tyler Stewart, and even Justin Jarvis slated to be ready to come up this season. I think it was on MLB Pipeline, had their ETA at 2024. Could we see McGill, Buddo, and Peterson move to the bullpen and help out in that area?
Yeah, I think that's another thing, is that you have to have the flexibility, especially like I said about a guy like McGill. McGill had the upper 90s velocity at times, and if maybe in a bullpen role like we saw with Sean Manaea, he went out there and he reinvented himself to go out there and dominate. You know, you never know. You just can't be. I think the days of you kind of being able to dictate. I was a guy like that myself. As I came up through the minor leagues, I was a starter. I was an upper echelon starter that at every level I was top five in numbers across the board, but it wasn't happening fast enough. And then when I got to the big leagues, they're like, well, you know, we need a reliever. We don't need a starter. And I'm like, well, I can pitch less innings. That's fine. Like, just give me the opportunity. And at first they were like, no, you're not a reliever. I'm like, but most guys start as starters and then become relievers. You just got to give me the opportunity. But it was one of the hardest things that I ever had to do as the long man, is sit there and wait for one of my teammates to get beat up so that I could pitch and I could perform. It's a mental thing that you have to get over, and you have to keep working and staying sharp and being ready. And just, hey, I might only be in before five innings or after the ninth inning, you know, like, and that it is what it is until you prove that you are out pitching other people. So if that's what it takes, hey, at this point, is it, do you want to go to Syracuse or do you want to be in New York? And I think that's the bottom line, right? So I do think their stuff can play, because like I said, I think they can minimize what they are looking to do and use two pitch combinations and be able to go through the three hitters that they face in the sixth or seventh and help the team find a way to win ball games.
I don't know if it's a organizational concept with the Mets, but they never seem to want to, either vice versa, where it's bring the pitcher up as a reliever and then get him into a starter, or the opposite way, if he's not working out, start putting into the reliever. I mean, one of the most successful, and this name goes in Mets lore for all the wrong reasons, but
here we go.
Adam Wainwright, man, he started in the bullpen in the playoffs and then he became a really good starter. Why don't teams do this more? You know, especially the Mets, who have had, you know, these pitching prospects who we've talked a lot about and had high hopes for that, you know, they don't work out. And then it's then they just don't know what to do with them. They either release them or trade them instead of, you know, maybe we should make him a reliever or let's put up his innings a lot. Maybe that changes now since the whole philosophy of pitching has changed and more reliance on relievers. Maybe that changes in openers and stuff like that. But I don't know why they never were really into doing that.
Yeah. First off, Stroman, 2 years, $37 million with the Yankees.
Wow.
Just signed.
He's going to give them innings. He gave the Mets innings, and everyone didn't want him.
he was fantastic in a Met uniform. He's a fantastic pitcher, bottom line. Yes, he comes with baggage, but I think the Yankee culture and for a chance to win in the Bronx and knowing that, you know, the lineup that they have, he's going to have a good chance to make himself, you know, a chance to win a ring. I think that straightens everybody up. We've seen it done before. Guys cut their hair, beards, and everything else, and kind of fit in more so than anything. So, you know, good for him. So one of the things I will say is that there's none of this is an easy formula. This isn't like plug and play, and it always works. Moneyball, everybody talks about Moneyball. Do you remember, did Moneyball win a championship? It did not. But everybody talks about Moneyball. Like, what a great way to do it. This is how it should be done. We're still talking about Moneyball 25 years later, and yet they didn't win anything. So I got it. Small market team made it to the playoffs. Nice, but they didn't win. You look
they didn't
at
make it to the championship series either. They just made it to the
division. Correct. Right. So now you take a look at even the last 16 years, there's not been a back-to-back champion. You know, the Giants have been the closest to go. Was it 2010, 12, and 14? To be able to go, the Dodgers have gone to World Series but haven't won except for the 2020 Asterix World Series. So there's no one way to do this. We talk about it all the time about, you know, how much money do you spend? Are you keeping up with the Joneses? And that was one of the biggest knocks on the Wilpons, right? Oh, they're not paying the rent, but they never got return on their investment. How many times did they get scorned or burnt on a deal? I think the only one that I could talk about that I think came back and they got their money's worth was Beltran. Besides that, everybody else fell short of, you know, even fulfilling their duties throughout the contract, you know, injuries and whatnot. So I'll say it this way. If you look at the Texas Rangers who won the World Series last year, one of the things that people said was, oh, Bruce Bochy was at the helm. They must not be very strong analytically. They're old school. This is the way they did it. And actually it was the exact opposite. Bruce Bochy joined one of the biggest analytical departments who since 2018, I want to say they either can quintupled their staff. But the funny part was, as I was watching this video, it was from June of last season, and they were doing this whole thing about how they're moving from the way that they were storing all their information because of all the cross-reference points and the minor leagues and everything else. It was just too much data. It was getting lost, and they had a lake house, Amazon lake house, that was storing all the information where you could fill it up, and then it would just kind of put it to the side, fill up and put it aside. Great. Having said that, the guy says, he starts out and goes, we've been doing this since 2018. I started this program with all the different things that we do and what we're finding out about each guy and how we individualize their performance and what they should be really focusing on, how their swing should be on every single swing, a 22 degree launch angle for every swing, whether you hit the ball or don't hit the ball. This is what we're going with. And the guys, like, you know, they started naming all the guys, even the kid who won the MVP, he was a guy who they said, remember, he got DFA'd and everything else, and they brought him back and they said, you need to do this. You are a fly ball hitting machine. Hit fly balls. When they go over the wall, great. When they get to the wall, great. If they are an out, so what? You're going to make an out anyway. 600 at bats, you're going to make out at least 400 times. Okay, so get used to it. So it was crazy to think that he starts out this whole thing and he says, the last 5 years that I've been here, we have had a losing season every single year. In fact, we finished dead last two of the 5 years in our own division. And as they were playing that season, he's like, we're currently doing pretty good, but we're still not really where we need to be. And then all of a sudden it clicked. And then all of a sudden all these guys were hitting. And then all of a sudden they had the kid Evans who came up and he went from the second round pick that nobody had heard of. They didn't even have a mugshot of him at the draft to, oh my God, this kid just batted over 300 in the World Series and had a slugging percentage over 600. Like, they understood that it took time to do this. In fact, they lost 96 games last year. 96 they lost, but they made it to the World Series and won the whole thing because They struck while the iron was hot. They figured out that they had to replace a guy like DeGrom, so they went out and got Montgomery and they got Scherzer. Their bullpen was solid up and down, even though they got some pieces there too. Their lineup got healthy at the right time, with Seager being in and out of the lineup for a long, Semien the same thing. Those guys got healthy, and then all the young guys that they had played above, you know, what they were thought to be. A guy like Garcia just took it to another level. We saw that with we saw that with Murphy in 2015 with the Mets. So there's no rhyme or reason to it. There's no set way to do this, and I think that's the beauty of baseball. Just when you think you got it figured out, you don't. But what I do know is I will never, ever accept that Fangraphs had my team at a 12% chance to make the playoffs in July. So that's why we should not compete anymore. That was the biggest BS I have ever heard from any front office person. Because if you're using Fangraphs to tell me as a fan that that's the reason you don't think you can compete, there's something really wrong. Because you just told all those other guys that if we're playing well, we'll add pieces. If we're playing well, we'll still go for it. And to see that they finished, you know, they had 75 wins. You had the Diamondbacks with 84 wins. I think 9 games was not out of the realm of possibility if you kept that team together, because every guy you sold off made it to the playoffs with their expected teams. So I don't know. I just think that's food for thought when it comes to a GM and a vision. And let's see what David Stearns is able to do.
Yeah, I thought that they were kind of starting to hit a little bit of a stride. Verlander was getting healthy. Scherzer was getting healthy. Robertson was pitching outstanding for the role that he had to play in that. And then they got rid of Robertson, got rid of Scherzer, got rid of Verlander. It's like, okay, I guess we're done now.
Just as you think, they were just saying that, right? If you're playing better as we get to the deadline, we're going to add pieces. And a week earlier, you get rid of your closer to a division rival.
Yeah.
For a 17-year-old Dominican outfielder. And I'm like, wait a minute, what just happened? Like, why are you pulling the plug so early? Give it another week. He's a closer. You know there's going to be a market for him. Like, I didn't understand that. And the bailout of, you know, going and selling off all those pieces and getting back, prospects in return and saying, oh man, they did great. You know, they redid their farm system. I think it's something like 9 of the 17 prospects now are in the upper, you know, double A or triple A, you know, and are, like you said, are ready to make the jump in 2024. They're on pace to make the jump. But at the same time, I'm looking at I gave away Justin Verlander for 3 seasons or 3
and
postseasons.
And you're paying him.
And you're paying him. And you got back 2 outfielders, not one arm that throws a ball forward or can help you in that aspect, where you gave up not just a ace of the staff, but a future Hall of Famer, who, as you said, was pitching, I think he was pitching to like a 1.9 ERA in his last, 1.7 ERA in his last 9 starts before he got traded. And yet there he was gone before we knew it. And we're paying him to pitch for the Houston Astros. And you wanted me to say that was a great job by the front office.
You know, the funny thing too is that this team, I think I don't know if it was definitely second half post trade deadline, played 500 or at least really close to 500
with guys you didn't know.
Yep.
With guys that weren't going to make the roster at any point. Tommy Pham had really stepped it up in a major way when Vogelback, the whole Vogelback thing, you know, the downfall of Buck Showalter was Billy Epler being able to say Vogelback is our guy and he's going to be our DH. And he's going to provide Pete Alonso protection in the middle of the lineup. That made zero sense. And I always said that, you know, it's a shame that Buck Showalter went from manager of the year to ousted because of things that were out of his control. They were obviously making lineups. They were obviously pushing the buttons they want to. They pulled the plug on the season. And yet at the end of the day, he was let go and he had never had a conversation with the president of baseball operations when he let him go. Even though he said, you know, I'm looking for someone who shares my vision. You never spoke to the man. So how do you know what vision that was?
Pete Alonso still looking for protection 5 to 6 years into coming into the league. Hopefully at some point he gets gets it this season. I don't know. There's been talks about maybe a Jorge Soler, but I'm not too sure with the way that the spending has gone. I'm not too sure. It might be Vientos, DJ Stewart. So we'll see what happens on that front. Before I let you go, we recently found out about the passing of Mets Hall of Famer Bud Harrelson, two-time All-Star Gold Glover, 1971, 1969 World Series champion for the amazing Mets. The only Met to be in a Mets uniform for both World Series championships as a player in 69, as a third base coach in 86. And he also managed the Mets following the firing of Davey Johnson for that 1990 season and the 1991 season. What are your thoughts on Bud Harrelson? And have you ever had any interaction with him during your tenure with the Mets?
Oh, I did, in and out with Bud Harrelson several different times. One of those gutsy, gritty guys who made you fall in love with the blue and orange. He was the kind of player, you know, that he was as a coach. He embodied that 86 team, right? And you see Ray, remember who was it? Eric Davis slid in and Ray Knight starts punching him in the face. And I mean, Bud Harrelson was probably one of the first guys out there ready to, you know, go toe to toe. He had that fight, of course, and famously with Pete Rose, but that was kind of what you grew up loving. You know, he was manager of the Long Island Ducks for a long, long time. Got to meet him out there several times. He was just one of those people that was so well respected, so beloved as a Met, and it didn't matter about his numbers. And I always say that to people about the difference between, you know, like a Met fan and a Yankee fan. Yankee fans are all about their World Championship rings and their players who, you know, put up these unbelievable numbers, Hall of Fames and everything else. You know what? We gave every one of the players that we fall in love with, we know they leave it all out on the field. They give you everything they got, whether it's, you know, whether it's enough, it hasn't been other than two World Series. But those guys, especially that 86 team, Bud Harrelson exemplified that, and just the way that he, the gritty, the take nothing from no one kind of attitude, where I came here today to win. Don't give a damn who you are, especially if you came to Shea Stadium. You were going to make sure that they left remembering that they were there.
Figgy, let everyone know what you got coming up and what you're working on and how everyone can follow you on social media if they're not doing so right now.
So again, I've been working at WPIX weeknights at 7 p.m. Me and Mark Malusis do a show called Sports Nation Nightly. Sports debate show going in on, you know, from a New York perspective with everything going on. And, you know, the Jets and Giants didn't disappoint us as far as media coverage that we can talk about them. So we do that five nights a week at 7 p.m. Of course, hopefully we're back again. Amazing But True with Jake Brown, our podcast about the New York Mets. And also, you know, I just did the Polar Plunge. Finally, Coney Island boy growing up, I got to jump into those freezing waters on New Year's Day, which was a lot of fun. Helped to raise some money there. It was great. Other than that, man, I'm excited about spring training. I'm excited about, you know, the upcoming season. I'm excited about seeing, of course, Crosstown, seeing Soto and Judge in a lineup. I think that's going to be really, really exciting to see what they're capable of doing. But, you know, there's a lot of new for the first time in a long time with the Mets. And it'll be interesting to see how everything gels together once, you know, the opening bell rings in April.
This has been fun and very informative. And Figgy, I hope that we can do this again. I really appreciate your time, man.
Anytime, brother. You know that. Appreciate it.
All right. Nelson Figueroa, everyone, former Mets pitcher, like he said, co-host of the Amazing But True podcast with Jake Brown and co-host of Sports Nation Nightly on WPIX 11 with Mark Malusis. Figgy, you have a great one, man. Take care. Thank you.
You got it, brother. Take care.
All right. That was Nelson Figueroa. So great talking to him. I said that he was the guy that I had to have on today to talk about the pitching staff. So I really appreciated him coming on and doing that with us. And that wraps up this Subway to Shea podcast. Follow Subway to Shea on Instagram and TikTok at Subway to Shea. Listen to the Subway to Shea podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can watch on YouTube. Hit that subscribe and follow button to turn on your notifications and never miss an episode of Subway to Shea. You can rate the show and leave comments for me to review. It really helps me out big time, so I appreciate all of the comments and discussion. Thank you, everyone, for tuning and helping my podcast grow each and every week. The podcast is yours as much as it is mine, so you continue to be a major part of that and a major part of the success of Subway to Shea brand, and I appreciate every single one of you. So for Anthony Rivera, this This is the Subway to Shea podcast. And always remember, let's go Mets.